Hello there. Welcome to the LexisNexis webinar on succession planning in 2020. This was an interesting webinar to write because we've basically been living succession planning 2020 over the last year. It's been a crazy year, to put it mildly, a year that none of us imagined would be come January the 1st. And it's certainly been a year where private client practitioners and the law in general has had to improvise, has had to adapt, and has had to also look forward as to what changes may be coming. My role is heading up a department in central London at Kingsley Napier LLP, and my colleague Stephanie Mooney has been very ably assisting me with a huge amount of work over 2020, and she'll be joining us later in the webinar to cover some of the topics that we're going to cover. Heading a department to dealing with private clients coming into 2020 and with the first lockdown has posed a huge number of challenges. There's no doubt that we have been busier than ever before. And I think, as you'll see from the setting the scene slide, in April, the Law Society reported that will inquiries had increased by 75%. I get asked quite a lot, has 2020 been all about probates and COVID? Well, it's not necessarily been about probates per se. It's been actually about people really resetting their life, thinking very carefully about the future. There's been a lot of family time, as you can imagine, in 2020. There's been a lot of time for reflection. And so a lot of the work that we've seen has been people coming to us wanting to update, change, or even just start the succession planning process. It has meant a huge amount of work coming through the door, aided by Zoom, which is what I'm recording the webinar on at the moment, because we can quickly speak and visually see people without the kind of rigmarole of getting them into the offices. So there's been a huge churn. There's been a lot of concern by clients. There's been a lot of urgency from clients. And it has meant that we have had to work very hard and also consider what are the best avenues for our clients to go down. And all of this is in the shadow of post-COVID. When I'm recording this, the day, about 25 minutes until we get the TIAs announced coming out on the 26th of November. We've just had Rishi Sunak talking yesterday about the grim economic forecast. So everything we've done this year has been in the shadow that we know we've got tax rises coming. And so it's been a very interesting year from that perspective. And with that in mind, what Stephanie and I have tried to do in this webinar is to summarize what we've seen, what type of actions clients have favored, and what we can maybe do to prepare for the future. On the next slide, you'll see a little bit more what the webinar covers. So just to spell it out a little bit clearly, a little bit more clearly. So it was an overview of some of the practical issues that we found as private client practitioners. Lockdown, not being able to see clients face to face, etc., has brought amongst a huge number of issues, and therefore we've had to adapt. Stephanie's going to go into detail about how we've adapted and how some law has even been changed to help us adapt. We're also going to have a really quick look at some of the problems that we've had as a private client group in terms of delays at various government and financial institutions. I know a lot of that's often relevant for probate, but I think it's very important that whenever you're talking to a client at this present moment, that you manage their expectations where third-party government agencies or financial institutions are in play. I'm then going to focus on some potential tax changes that may be coming down the line. And this includes information provided us well before COVID. Tax changes are certainly nothing new. There's been a lot of discussion over the last couple of years. I think some of it surrounds around simplifying the tax. Some of it is going to obviously surround by impending Brexit. And now we've got COVID and the big black hole. I'm going to be looking not just at what could happen, but how to maybe advise clients just in case it does happen. We're then Stephanie's going to step back in and talk a little bit about some of the asset protection devices that we've been using in wills over the last year. Asset protection certainly has been the buzzword as far as our clients are concerned. She's also going to talk a little bit about some inheritance tax planning that we've done. Before I jump in again to cover company wills, which is a phrase that's cropped up a number of times this year, and also just looking at family investment companies, which has become a very popular succession planning vehicle. And we've seen a huge uptick in advising and preparing family companies. But what I am going to also be looking at is some of the issues surrounding family investment companies, and some potential changes that may be on the horizon, albeit nothing concrete. And finally, Stephanie's going to finish off talking just about the importance of lasting powers of attorney. I can't remember really ever doing a webinar where I haven't actually finally just ended with lasting powers of attorney. It's such an important aspect, especially in the current world we live in. So we do like to talk about it, and hopefully you'll still be with us and still awake at that point. So on that note, I'm going to hand over to Stephanie, and she can talk about how we've had to adapt in these difficult times with lockdowns, etc.
Thanks for the introduction, James. There's been quite a lot of difficulties for many people, private client practitioners included, over the past few months. One of the main issues we've had is not being able to have those face-to-face meetings with clients that we all love as social beings. It's been more difficult to take instructions, to explain tricky concepts to clients, and just to ensure that documents such as wills and lasting powers of attorney are actually being executed properly. Zoom has been a real saviour in this regard. It's obviously not as good as seeing clients in real life, but it has been the next best thing. I do think there are a few issues that we'll all be familiar with Zoom. Meetings at the office or at a client's home do allow you to control the conditions a bit more, so you know who is there and that there's no one lurking in the background creating any concerns about undue influence. So it's just been more important, really, just to have more conversations with clients to satisfy ourselves that they understand what's being proposed and that they're completely happy to move forward with any estate planning steps that we've proposed. Zoom hasn't always been ideal for more elderly clients, particularly when we went into our first lockdown. I find that I did find that I had to do quite a lot of hand holding just to get the client onto a video call in the first place. Over time, this has definitely got easier. I think most of us have just got used to living our lives through video calls. So everybody across the board seems to be pretty familiar with using that mechanism now. In some cases, real life client meetings have still been possible. And in some cases, there's just no substitute where something needs to be dealt with urgently, or you need to get to meet someone to prepare a will for them pretty quickly. James mentioned about some new law. This is in relation to the video witnessing of wills. I think this may be useful to some, but for me, I've not relied on it at all. And I do very much see it as a last resort, mainly because of the number of issues it brings up and the risk of there being challenges further down the line. So first of all, you've got the fact it's just a tricky management task in general to have a different Zoom call with each person who needs to sign. Then you've got the difficulty of relying on the post to send the will between each person and all of the risks that the post presents. I think the video witnessing option generally is fine for clients, maybe existing clients that you've known for some time, where they just want to make a few small changes, such as changing the age at which their children inherit. But if you've got a case where it's a newer client or someone who wants to make more substantial changes to the will, so something extreme like cutting someone out, I really wouldn't be comfortable allowing that process to essentially take place over video and have the video witnessing take place on Zoom, for example. If you are going down the route of having a will witnessed over video, I would just say keep it simple, re-execute once you're able to meet with the client so that everything can be done in the normal way that is more comforting to all of us. In most cases, I have found that it's actually been perfectly possible for even relatively vulnerable clients to find two witnesses who can safely witness their will. We've just had to be more creative in how this is done. So your typical over the garden fence example or park benches, it's just thinking of those little details to make sure it's all done safely. So making sure each person has their own pen, so you're not just passing around the same pen to each person. I'd say that when it comes to actually executing estate planning documents, it's lasting powers of attorney that have been a particular admin nightmare. And I think that's just because so many people are required to sign and required to sign in a particular order. So we've really had to rely more on producing lots of copies, just sending out original signature pages to each person who needs to sign. And something that's been a bit different for us is we're used to being the certificate provider on most clients' LPAs, and partly just for logistic reasons, it's made sense for clients to perhaps find someone else who fits the criteria of a certificate provider, so they're able to meet them comfortably, meet them locally, and sign as donor at the same time as that certificate provider. All in all, I don't mean to just sound completely negative, but when it comes to LPAs, there's no easy way of dealing with them while we're in lockdown, while we're working from home, while we're still, a lot of us, heavily reliant on paper. It's just a case of ensuring consistency of approach within individual private client teams and having a system in place just to make sure you know how you're dealing with the vast amount of papers that are circulating. So the next slide is titled, "We're going as quick as we can." That is very true, but it has proven very difficult due to the number of delays at different institutions. This has just been a natural product of the current situation. There's reduced staff levels in a lot of places. We've found that really the most significant delays are with the Office of the Public Guardian when it comes to getting LPAs registered. We pretty much always go down the route of registering LPAs as soon as they've been signed, but it is taking a number of months to get back registered LPAs at the moment. I had a married couple clients who recently, very sadly, contracted COVID and they're quite unwell. I got in touch with the OPG because the LPAs hadn't really got very far in the process, it seemed. I was advised that they do have an urgent track and that they can accelerate the process where clients are extremely unwell. But there's some inherent delays built into the process. So the actual urgent process only really helps in getting the LPA allocated to a caseworker and then getting the registered LPA sent out at the end of the process. There's a standard period you have to wait of the 4 weeks where it can't be registered in that time. And the urgent process also doesn't seem to help the admin part at the start of LPAs just being scanned onto the system at the OPG in the first place. So we've definitely had to think quite practically in light of the delays and what clients can do, not necessarily all formal legal options. So things like just encouraging clients to write down their wishes, even if they're not in the ideal legal form we'd want them to be in. Or say it comes to things like assets, bank accounts, simple things like having a third party mandate to allow a trusted person to access their accounts if they need to do so. Even things like considering a general power of attorney in the interim, just if the client has capacity but just wants a bit of help. The key thing in all of this I've found is just making clients aware of the delays at the outset just to manage their expectations. Probate on the whole has surprised me in not being a massive issue. There have been some delays, but they're not as bad now as they were at the start of the pandemic, and we're still gradually receiving grants. The thing is, when it comes to the overall estate administration side of things, most institutions are still only dealing with things by paper, which can really slow things down when a lot of us are working from home and don't have easy access to our offices and our printers and scanners, etc. So things like claim forms and account closure forms just need to be completed and signed really early on in the process, so that when you get the grant, you're not then having further delays to get access to funds. HMRC, they generally seem to be operating with fairly standard times, but those standard times are definitely not quick. Certain modifications in HMRC's procedures have been really useful. So I've found it really helpful that professional agents are able to sign IHT 400s on behalf of personal representatives. What would be good is if HMRC extended it to other forms. So I've got a client who's an executor of an estate and she's based in the US. It was great that I could sign the IHT 400 on her behalf, but then we had an IHT loss on shares IHT form to submit, and that one HMRC needed to be signed with a wet signature. So it would just be good if some of these processes were put in place for other things to make life easier. There's definitely been a move to make things digital in this area, in particular preparing probate applications online. I have noticed a bit of a reluctance to fully embrace this. I mean, I personally still do quite a lot of applications on paper, but as online grant applications will soon be required in most cases, there is a need for us all to start embracing this change so we can just get familiar with the process, which hopefully will be beneficial to us in the long term. Over to you, James.
Thank you, Stephanie. Very, very fulsome, and just showing the type of issues that we have been having to deal with. Obviously, not as many issues as some of our more entrepreneurial clients who have seen all of their businesses suffer in such in these difficult times. But we've managed to rise to the challenge. One thing, though, that we can't give any definite advice upon, but what I'm going to spend the next couple of slides on, is in relation to what 2021 is going to see and what planning we should be doing now in 2020. There is no doubt that tax rises are coming in some form or another. As I mentioned, we're recording on the day after Rishi Sunak gave his spending review update, and the numbers are pretty eye-boggling in the wrong direction. The Office for Budget Responsibility is talking about 27 billion. Reading the newspapers this morning, we're talking about 40 billion. And these are the type of numbers we're going to have to be raising either through spending cuts or through tax increases. But don't be drawn into believing that tax rises or tax changes weren't on the agenda before COVID. In our area of law, and in relation to succession planning, there were two important papers published in July 2019, following on from something that was done in 2018 by the Office of Tax Simplification, and another report in 2020 by the rather catchy all-parliamentary group on inheritance tax and intergenerational fairness. And these definitely require to be looked at by any practitioner. I'm sure everyone tuning in is aware of these reports, but I'm just going to spend a few minutes on them to review the key premise behind them, and then manage to see where we can maybe make changes for clients in terms of their ownership of assets and their succession planning. The first one you'll see is the Office of Tax Simplification, and I'll be talking about them again a little bit regarding capital gains tax, but there's been generally quite a lot of looking at and considering inheritance tax over the years, business property relief or business relief and agricultural relief are areas which have been looked at time and time again, either by the courts or by HMRC. As you are no doubt aware, that's just say, for instance, business relief, which is the easiest one to look at and the most common one in terms of most practitioners. Where we're standing at the moment is that a business needs to be mainly dealing with a trading activity. And most people have taken that as kind of over 50%. And that trading activity obviously can't be just investing in property. or investing in investments. We have in the past, over the last few years, managed to achieve business relief on a number of assets that have had an underlying property asset in it, for instance, hotels, bed and breakfasts, etc. But they have been trading businesses and they have been allowed to pass free of inheritance tax. What the Office of Tax Simplification was saying in their report is that maybe this kind of 50%, over 50%, the mainly bit should be increased to fall more in line with some of the capital gains tax relief, such as holdover relief and entrepreneurs relief, and should be looking at maybe even in excess of 80% of the business should be a trading business. This would obviously change a lot of businesses and their potential for tax relief. But I don't think clients should necessarily be too scared about that. There are steps that they can take within the businesses during their lifetime to increase the trading element. Also, much better to see an increase in the trading element than a removal of that exemption entirely. We look after a huge number of entrepreneurs. We look after clients with long-term family businesses, passing between generations. And actually, the removal of business relief from what would be a perfectly legitimate 100% trading business would have huge effects of the ability for the next generation to continue to manage it if suddenly they're losing potentially 40% of the value in their business. Even though I'm sure they could pay the tax over a period of time, it would still be a huge imposition. So talking about increasing it wouldn't necessarily be an unfriendly move. It may also make it a little bit clearer for us practitioners about what a business needs to do to get the relief. Maybe we look at it a bit more closely. In terms of other comments, and one that is basically ringing true of a number of reports, is the discussion about the capital gains tax uplift on death. As it stands, you can get a capital gains tax uplift and no inheritance tax if you leave your assets to your spouse, or indeed the assets qualify for business relief or agricultural relief. So it is incredibly tax efficient, and in some respects can assist with deathbed planning, where assets maybe are passed to the individual, say the spouse who's particularly unwell and has far shorter life expectancy than the other spouse. I think we all knew that was going to be looked at some point, but the Office of Tax Simplification is really looking at it, whether as an excuse, saying actually it's preventing people from maybe passing assets during their lifetime if they know they're going to get a capital gains tax uplift on death. I think that's probably one of the weaker arguments to it, but it's still something which was mentioned in July 2019's report, that if, for instance, there was a buy-to-let flat in the name of the deceased, and it was passed inheritance tax-free to the deceased spouse, that the deceased spouse would pick it up based on a valuation that the deceased paid for it, so the deceased acquisition cost. Now, this is obviously going to be incredibly complicated to arrange, because death is not going to wipe, if death doesn't wipe out capital gains where there's no inheritance tax, there's going to be the necessity for some very good recording of information, because unfortunately the person who's done the purchase would have died. So that takes away quite a major source of this kind of evidence required for capital gains tax. So that could be a change. I would say it's most likely to be a change, and it's certainly something to bear in mind when you're planning now. There was a talk about reducing the 7 years in terms of the potentially exempt transfer anti-avoidance time down to 5 years. That is very positive on the face of it. That gives people a shorter period of time to survive. And it also simplifies the record keeping by taking off a couple of years. However, it would go hand in hand with the abolition of taper relief if the Office of Tax Simplification had its way. So you wouldn't see after 3 years a benefit for making a gift above the available nil rate band. But I do think in general that's probably a positive step. I personally was thinking more that it was going to go from 7 to 12, and it could still do that because these are just recommendations. But again, I think what what a lot of the simplification viewpoints, whether it be this or for capital gains tax, is trying to simplify the process of reporting tax or gifts or anything like that to HMRC, rather than extending a timeline to make it more complicated for the, for say the executors or the people making the gift. In 2020, early 2020, I think Jan-Feb time, the all parliamentary group reported some far more reaching, far changing inheritance tax position, where instead of this 40%, which was still part of the Office of Tax Simplification, actually looking at basically throwing that out the window, bringing in a 10% inheritance tax on all estates. It didn't directly say this, but the likelihood is that would go up to 20% on estates or on assets over £2 million. That obviously is a huge reduction, down from 40% and potentially 20% in terms of chargeable transfer taxes. So cutting it in half. And the idea being is it would make it more palatable for individuals paying the tax, because inheritance tax is our wealth tax and is a hugely hated tax. However, that would go hand in hand with a big change in terms of lifetime gifts, where there would be a cap on lifetime gifts before there became a gift tax. That gap, that cap was considered to be £30,000 a year, and over that you'd be paying 10% on a tax on the gift. That can certainly stymie the passing of assets between generations. There are plenty of countries with gift taxes, the US being the main one. And one of the things that I always say to people is that, yes, we have a punitive inheritance tax regime, but we could, you know, if someone has £50 million, they could give £50 million, survive the 7 years, and there's no inheritance tax on that. So the idea of actually paying tax upfront on a gift, or some sort of mechanism to count that tax, whether it gets collected later, may prevent people from passing assets down to the next generation, which I believe is a vitally important source of wealth for the younger generation, who are definitely struggling more maybe than the baby boomers, you know, the people in their 60s, 70s and 80s at the moment. There was also, again, the mention of removal of the capital gains tax uplift on death. And that's any uplift, I believe. So not just in relation to assets passing to spouses. It did say that the spouse relief would remain, and that the likelihood there'd be a nil rate band somewhere, something similar, but it did remove business relief and agricultural relief, which again could have a huge impact on businesses in order for their viability to pass on to the next generation. Those may entirely be ignored, these two reports, but it just shows the type of processes and the type of thinking that is going through people who are examining the taxes. I would suggest that the removal of the capital gains tax uplift, particularly for assets going to spouses, is likely to be number one in the hit zone. But they may cherry pick other aspects of those reports when they're coming to review inheritance tax in more detail. Albeit the 2020 report is such a wholesale change, that would require an awful lot of effort, a lot of work, and a lot of communication with stakeholders as to whether that would be appropriate. What we have seen, though, is a cut significantly in entrepreneurs' relief that was all the talk pre-COVID, down to £1 million during your life as opposed to £10 million, which definitely was. I didn't quite see the logic of it, but you know, in theory, it was to prevent, I'm sure, people paying too little capital gains tax and potentially being able to mitigate their income tax bill by using entrepreneurs relief. 10% is a small tax number, and I think as far as HMRC and the Treasury considered, that entrepreneurs relief was not the incentive for people to be getting into entrepreneur business. I have to say that all the entrepreneurs I work with, entrepreneurs relief is a vital tool for them, or has been a vital tool for them in terms of building their business, knowing that they're going to be taking the lion's share of the profits out of it when they do decide to sell. In terms of the future and what Rishi Sunak has planned, we have just had published a report on capital gains tax. It's on the 11th of November. It's the first report. It's worth just having a quick look at that. I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail, but it's a simplification report, which is talking a little bit about some potential changes. It does indeed mention that capital gains tax uplift and where there is no inheritance tax should be abolished on death. So that's very important. It talks about aligning the capital gains tax position more with the income tax position. It also talks about how maybe the annual exemption should be lower, etc. But there are a couple of key things in there which we should hold on to. Firstly, in order to simplify capital gains tax, especially if we're going to increase the tax rate significantly from either 18%, 20% or 28%, there was talk in the document that maybe the government should consider a rebasing of assets. They suggested the year 2000. That would clearly be very welcome, as you would gains in the 80s and 90s would then suddenly disappear. However, logistically, it would be a very hard exercise on things like property if that was relevant, with the number of valuations that would be required. But if they're trying to simplify the process, then that does seem very sensible. So that's one thing. Secondly, is that there was talk about some sort of inflationary measures. Historically, we had indexation, which would allow effectively an asset that has grown naturally in value following the inflation, not to be the owner of that asset, not to be unfairly penalized simply by doing nothing with the asset and it just grows along with other assets through inflation. So that could be very interesting, especially for people who have held assets for a long time. And you may actually find that if inflationary measures are introduced, that the capital gains tax bill is not quite as hideous as it may be if it mirrors income tax entirely. And certainly that's how it played out previously. So moving on to the next slide. The one last thing, corporation tax, talk about it going from, say, 19% up to 24%. Again, that's not guaranteed, but it's something that is certainly either being leaked by HMRC and the Treasury or indeed is being predicted by economists, etc. So the next slide, tax rises are coming, preemptive actions advised. Right at the beginning, I talked about how this has been, 2020 has been a period of reflection like no other. People have been worried about whether they have enough money for the rest of their life. People have been worried about tax rises. People have been worried about family situations and maybe taking steps now that they wouldn't have otherwise taken the year before. But in terms of tax mitigation, for any wealthy client that you may have, it is important to have a conversation with them about whether there's any steps they can take in terms of mitigating or lessening the impact of future tax rises. Now, some of my clients already undertook such exercises pre the general election, as they were particularly worried about Corbyn. That time has passed, but now we've got potential tax rises. So the first one, and the one that is a tax that is almost certainly going to be looked at, and maybe as soon as the spring budget, is in relation to capital gains tax. So is this a good time to sell? Is this a good time to gift? There's no doubt that there's been quite a lot of selling of buy-to-let properties, from what I can understand, reading in the press, where landlords, combined with the mortgage relief becoming less, mortgage relief coming off the profits being less favourable for higher rate taxpayers, there has been a lot of selling of buy to let properties. But whether the market's good for that or not is another matter. But people will take a view maybe to take the 28% capital gains tax with both hands rather than wait for what could be a lot worse post the spring budget. One change that has occurred this year is that any seller of a property needs to be paying capital gains tax within 30 days. And that's residential property. So it's not possible to hold on to that capital gains tax liability for almost a year or even over a year. That is something which isn't been taken away from us. So that's on selling. Well, selling, at least you have the proceeds. Where clients have to be very wary is if they're gifting the property, they're not going to have necessarily the proceeds to pay capital gains tax. They can't kick it into the long grass like they have traditionally been doing. A disposal, a gift is a disposal, will trigger capital gains tax, and therefore they need to have the money available straight away. I have a number of clients who are making substantial UK residential property gifts, particularly on properties which they want to stay in the family. They want to trigger the seven-year rule, and they want to pay 28% capital gains tax as opposed to any changes on the tax rate that may be coming down the line, and maybe even changes to the gifting tax or time frame, as mentioned on the previous slide. But please bear in mind that you can't tell the clients this is a definite. If indexation, if inflationary measures do come in, if a rebasing comes in, the clients could be better off waiting for the tax changes. Not all clients are going to be worse off. So this needs to be approached with caution. And there generally, as a rule, needs to be another reason. For instance, inheritance tax planning, not just capital gains tax mitigation planning when coming to the gifting. We talked a little bit about on the last slide the dangers that may be coming down the line for business relief, agricultural relief. So it's not a bad idea to consider gifting some of these assets now if it's possible, maybe through some form of discretionary trust setup where you can hold over capital gains. Again, you may actually want to trigger capital gains for reasons which we've talked about. But again, I wouldn't want to think that you're kind of amending the share structure of a company, or indeed giving away control of a company simply because you're worried about the relief going. We do have clear indications that they will be looked at, but it doesn't mean the relief will go entirely. In the end, it's such a crucial relief, we can't think that it will disappear, because if family businesses start having to be sold or fire sold because the founder dies, then that's going to have huge impact on employees, etc. So we hope that nothing too drastic is going to happen with business relief, but we are in a relatively benign inheritance tax regime at the moment. People may not think so, but the 7 years is perfectly survivable and indeed insurable against. So I would certainly consider taking advantage of this, especially where capital gains tax is 20% on shares. Which is, I can't imagine even with indexation, it's going to get any lower than that. So do take advantage of that if possible. Also consider how to take advantage of principal private residence relief, which there's no indication will be changed, but who knows once the floodgates are opened. So that is something to bear in mind. And finally, you know, a few years time, we may be seeing a wealth tax. So the ownership of large numbers of properties, second homes, third homes, fourth homes, may bring about a tax bill. So just bear in mind to that when it comes to planning. Now, I just want to hand back to Steph to talk about wills and asset protection. Thank you.
Thanks for that, James. Yeah, I've definitely noticed clients are very nervous about the murmurings of tax changes and potential tax rises coming in the next few months or the next few years. This is one of the things that's prompted clients to come to us a bit more in the past few months, wills being a major part of this. There's nothing new in clients prioritising inheritance tax mitigation and asset protection when they're thinking about wills and their estate planning. But the current climate has definitely made clients more focused on just ensuring that assets are preserved for future generations in as protected a fashion as possible. The simple everything to the survivor, then to the children wills that we used to see quite a lot do seem to be becoming less popular. And I find that I'm certainly drafting more flexible wills, incorporating a life interest trust or discretionary trust or both. I've noticed that life interest trusts on the first death are becoming more popular, and not just in the usual situation that we'd see it of a second marriage situation. I think a lot of clients realise that this can be quite a flexible tool to ring fence assets for the children whilst allowing the survivor that access to capital, provided it's drafted in that flexible way and they appoint the right trustees to manage the process. A lot of thought does go into how a life interest trust should be managed following the first death. So thoughts given to things like getting assets out of the trust down to the children fairly soon after the first death. But it will be interesting to see what happens with this whole CG base cost uplift issue, and if this is removed for spouses, as this could impact on a lot of our clients' plans, and I imagine we'll be having a few more conversations about that sort of thing in the coming months. Discretionary trusts are also becoming more popular on a second death situation. It's more and more becoming more favourable to an outright gift to children or a gift to children at a set age. I'm certainly noticing a pattern that the age at which parents consider it appropriate for their children to inherit is becoming later and later. So I think a discretionary trust is appealing to a lot of people just because of the usual concerns over, you know, a future divorce, concerns over a child inheriting too much too soon. And in a climate where clients are becoming ever conscious of inheritance tax and the risk of reform to that area, I think they find it appealing, the idea of potentially skipping a generation if their children are already suitably set up. Particularly some of the more elderly clients actually mainly want to look out for the grandchildren. So providing for this in a discretionary trust is generally a better way than potentially rocking the boat and missing out the children altogether and providing an outright gift to grandchildren. The benefits of a discretionary trust, which we're all familiar with, it just leaves things open as possible to react to changing circumstances. And as it stands, advantage can still be taken of that 2-year period post-death to reorganise things in a way that's both tax efficient and makes sense from a family perspective. So most of our time with wills in recent months has been focused not on drafting the will itself, but on the letter of wishes, and advising on the choice of trustees, which is really the key to any flexible will. We are finding that we need to remind clients that whilst it's great that you can have a flexible will incorporating trust that can be put away and not thought about for a while, the letter of wishes should be seen very much as a live document, and it does need to be revisited over time as the individual circumstances change and as the tax climate changes in the coming months or years. And on the subject of tax, I'll move us on to the next slide, which relates to inheritance tax. Inheritance tax is very much hated by most clients, and we've definitely seen a surge in clients coming to us wanting advice on their inheritance tax position and how this can be mitigated. Lifetime gifting continues to be one of the most straightforward and cost-effective ways of reducing the size of the estate for inheritance tax purposes. But understandably, this is rarely the first choice of many of our clients when it comes to inheritance tax mitigation. Lack of control is a big concern with outright gifting. And from our perspective and the client's perspective, it does very little in the way of asset protection, which is such a focus at the moment. As well as the inheritance tax implications, if a client dies within 7 years, there's also the capital gains tax position to consider, where a significant gift of non-cash assets is being contemplated. And that can put clients off. As James said, if you're looking at gifting, a lot of clients will be nervous about where they're going to find the liquidity to meet the capital gains tax bill. But in light of the tax changes that James has touched upon, whilst we don't know what's going to happen, it is perhaps a good time to make any gifts if this is an option that's being considered and is suitable for the client. And it's important to remember that some assets, so perhaps your flats and properties based in cities and some company shares, will have sadly suffered a bit of a drop in value recently, which can make it a good time to take advantage of this relatively benign tax climate to carry out gifting, which previously would have seemed just too costly. At the very least, even where clients don't have the appetite for making substantial outright gifts, it's just been a case of making sure that clients are aware of the basic inheritance tax reliefs and exemptions that are available to them. So things like small gifts exemption, normal expenditure out of income, these things just need to be kept in mind, because who knows how long they're going to be around for and if they'll remain as favourable as they are now. Gifts to trusts are quite often something that our clients are interested in. It can help solve the asset protection worries that outright gifting presents. It's also possible to address the capital gains tax problem, at least in the short to medium term, by holding over any gain. I find a lot of clients initially, when they're unfamiliar with trusts, think it's some magical solution that manages to avoid all inheritance tax. And sometimes when they realise the reality of it, they can be a little bit disappointed. So clients aren't always aware of the limitations on how much that can be transferred before there's an immediate inheritance charge, or that most discretionary trusts end up in the relevant property regime. But on the whole, it's just a case of reminding clients of the balancing exercise of managing an inheritance tax bill that you can plan for and deal with over time could be preferable to a surprise inheritance tax bill at any time on death. Another area that I will just touch on briefly is tax-friendly investing. It's something we still like to factor in when we are advising clients. So things like investing in assets qualifying for business relief while that's still around, products such as discounted gift trusts or gift and loan trusts. These, of course, do have some inherent risks in them and some complexities that the clients need to be aware of, but they definitely hold some advantages. And in some cases, reducing that 7-year survival period is a real help to some of our more elderly clients who might be a bit worried about their own mortality. And something which James will touch on a bit more later, family investment companies. I wasn't particularly involved with these at the start of my career, but in recent times, I've been doing them quite a lot. It just seems to be a very popular estate planning investment solution at the moment. I think a lot of clients like a corporate structure, which they can get their head around. A lot of our clients are business owners themselves, so they understand the mechanics behind a company structure, whereas a trust is a bit foreign to a lot of our clients. So that can certainly hold some advantages, particularly on the tax side of things. And it can be a good option now, as long as the costs don't outweigh the benefits. One final point, life insurance and pensions. We always factor these into any estate planning and inheritance tax mitigation conversations with the clients. We continue to check in with clients' financial advisors on these points just to make sure these assets are suitably structured, written in trust, and that in the case of life insurance, that they're paid for in the most tax efficient way, so through a company, for example. Thanks very much. I will pass back over to James.
Thank you, Stephanie. That was very good. I just wanted to touch upon a couple of areas that we've definitely seen becoming more prevalent over the last year. And this is not necessarily due to COVID. This was happening already. The first is in relation to businesses, and particularly in relation to founders of businesses or family businesses that want to be passed on to the next generation. We're certainly getting to a time where people born in the 40s, 50s, 60s are either have retired or closing in on retirement. And quite a lot of these individuals are taking advantage of being able to have a very, very good family business, very good entrepreneurial spirit, kind of in the 60s and 70s, develop something, and they want to pass it on. But how do you pass it on without causing difficulties within the next generation? How do you make sure the business can continue? And it's a constant debate that goes on. I've just put a little bit of statistic, but like all statistics, I'm sure they've got a degree of kind of leeway probably 25 to 30% either way. But, you know, a huge number of businesses will fail when a founder dies. And it just comes down to either lack of planning, lack of succession planning. And it is very hard if you build a business up to then hand it over to the next generation while you're still alive, because you don't want to see the next generation mess it up. And also things, you know, tax issues, the fact that maybe one child is involved in it and not another child, you know, plenty of issues like that will crop up. And, you know, those kind of soft issues. And also you've got a business which has been built in the shadow or in the image of an individual. And if they're not there, the contacts that may have been used, the clients that may have been used to keep that business going often can't be maintained. So it's not surprising that such businesses fail, but they shouldn't have to if the founder doesn't want it to. And this but this does require planning, does require conversations with people like Stephanie and myself, and also with corporate team and accountants to find ways in which this can be done, and ways in which it can be managed to the next generation. But if, for instance, there is not an orderly handover during lifetime, which can often be hard with tax issues, then we need to think about how this can be done on death. Now, there's no such thing as a company will. A will is a will. And you can't have lots of wills floating around without some degree of kind of careful drafting. I mean, obviously, you can have more than one will because often people have more than one wills with different jurisdictions. But invariably, a UK-based client will have one will. But how does that will actually deal with his or her company? Now, clearly, there is options within a will, as explained by Stephanie a couple of slides ago, to ring fence assets, to protect assets, whether it be in life interest trusts or discretionary trusts. So effectively, we are looking at those type of mechanisms in place to capture the shares that are being left by the deceased, and putting a framework together where they can be held and managed by named individuals, whether the executors or specifically named trustees. And then also having very clear framework as to how you want those individuals to manage the business, either the on, you know, the distribution of shares, the appointment of directors, etc. It actually really is quite a detailed process, but it still simply requires first and foremost a sensible will, sensible and carefully chosen trustees, and clear wishes. Clearly, there needs to be some flexibility. But the worst wills that I see are, say, leaving 100 shares between 10 people, and then it becomes divisive. You suddenly, you know, six of them can cause issues, eight of them can leave the other two of them out. So, you know, you don't want to be doing that, ideally, when it comes to leaving assets a business. And also, you have to be careful about who's actually going to run the business the day after you've died. It's quite frequent that we'll see people who are sole directors of businesses that have employees, that have ongoing projects. If they die, there's no director. There are some, for a different day, but there are some convoluted ways in which, through Companies House, et cetera, you can elevate a director pre-grant of probate. But fundamentally, it can freeze a company. It can prevent access to bank accounts. It can cause huge issues. And you're maybe paying a salary to people who require that salary every month just to put food on the table. So a bit of planning around that, maybe having a second or third director, having clear shareholders agreements if you have shares owned by other classes, making sure the articles fit in with what you want to do with the shareholders agreement, and making sure there's a degree of flexibility within the wills in order to benefit the family. One I've done recently actually is looking to gift quite a lot of shares to the employees, to key employees, subject to them wanting to stay on in the business after the founder's death. Now you're thinking, well, that, you know, he's got, you know, wife and children. So we're thinking, you know, is that something that they're going to miss out of the money that from the business? Well, the answer is that if they have 100% of a business that fails, then they've got nothing. So if they have 50% of a business that can continue because it incentivizes the staff to keep it going, then yeah, they have something. But we also look at other mechanisms, often alongside the financial advisor of the individual, where we can think about insurances to pay out to the family, whether it be relevant life policies or whether it be key man insurance to enable the company to buy the shares. These are absolutely crucial and are tax deductible within the structure to make sure that there is careful progression from the founder or major shareholder down to either the next generation or to other parties. And without that type of planning, unfortunately, businesses will often fail and people's livelihoods could be put at risk. So what I implore to any practitioner dealing with an entrepreneur or business client where the client has control over that business is to actually have these conversations. And even if they find it difficult to talk about their own demise, even if they think they're immortal, there's still things that can be put in place that's not going to affect the day-to-day running of the business, whether, as I say, whether it's insurances or careful will drafting, that won't impact the founder during his lifetime, but will allow the founder to pass on his shares, his business, his legacy intact. That's cropped up numerous times within our department in 2020, and I believe it's going to be a theme that will crop up more and more as the people who have set up these businesses are reaching retirement age, and there's plenty of them. Before I go on to the next slide, the one thing I want to say is that it doesn't have to be someone in their 70s or 80s that needs this type of advice. This advice should be given straight away to people setting up businesses. And while they've got a fledgling business, they may not want to talk about their death. And if they're in their 30s, they may not care about their death. It's worth, when there is value to any of these entities, having these conversations. If at the very least, it educates them to know that they need to have more detailed conversations further down the line. Okay. So the next slide, the last bit on succession planning before the final slide on lasting powers of attorney, just wanted to cover family investment companies. The title of the slide, Magic Bullet or Another Fine Mess, they are something which can be incredibly effective for succession planning and for other tax mitigation planning, but you are effectively taking away assets from an individual, putting them into a corporate structure, and not all clients are going to be happy with that. A corporate structure has its own set of complications, own set of laws, tax laws, management of company laws, etc. So I tend to find that for a start, family investment companies tend to suit clients who are used to dealing with companies. They're not for everyone. They're also can be expensive to set up and to run. So one of my cons side, setup cost is high. It can, it is easier to set up companies now than it ever has used to be. And practitioners tend to be more used to giving this advice. They're more common. And therefore, we just need to have a think about, the costing doesn't have to be astronomical, but they're not going to suit everybody. And on the con side as well, a lot of you may have read earlier on this year, could have been at the end of last year. I can't quite remember exactly when the announcement was, but it was probably more widely publicised earlier this year, that HM Revenue and Customs have set up a task force to review family investment companies. The kind of very hidden press release on this, as far as I could tell, was talking about family investment companies, kind of 20 million plus, and was actually talking about family offices quite a lot. So it may not be something that's entirely relevant for smaller companies, but it is something to bear in mind that the more anything is used to mitigate tax, the more likely it's going to be investigated and potentially regulated against. But before I go on to kind of where that regulation may exist within family investment companies, just want to talk about the advantages and why people would actually go down this route. Companies have their own set of rules and can be managed and set up from scratch how the person or the founder of the business wants the company to be managed. So the key thing about family investment companies is you can look at different classes of shares where you could have somebody who's a director of the business and indeed has the voting rights within the business, so the voting shares, controlling the company, but not actually owning any or very little of the economic rights of the company. So you'd have economic shares and you would have voting shares. These economic shares could quite easily be in the name of the next generation or in the name of a trust or spread out amongst a number of people. That kind of spread of economic rights does not have to impact on how the company's run. So effectively, you've got almost like a pseudo trust set up where you've got trustees who are the directors, and you've got beneficiaries, a number of beneficiaries sitting underneath who can't control the structure. And underneath those shareholdings, you can have indeed actual trusts, so that there's even a discretionary element to how those shares are sold. But not going into that in too much detail, family investment companies are a whole webinar by themselves. But effectively, you can have a pseudo trust set up with directors and shareholders separate, and they're not intertwining in terms of the management of the company. To get an asset within a company is difficult, and therefore you have to be think carefully. Gifting assets into a company can trigger the chargeable transfer charge, as if you were transferring that money into a trust. Therefore, quite often money is lent into a family investment company, and that money that's been lent into the company is still within the estate of the person who's made that loan. So it doesn't actually have any positive impact for inheritance tax purposes. So if somebody lends £2 million into a company, that £2 million figure is still within their estate if they were to die. However, the company has this money, has a loan agreement with that individual, and therefore actually it's zero value within the company. So the £2 million in the company, it owes £2 million out, which means that the shares can easily be gifted to beneficiaries without any kind of potentially exempt transfer issue, or indeed can be put into trust without any chargeable transfer issue. You then have a situation that over time, that £2 million can be repaid according to the loan agreement. But in the meantime, that money is invested, say, into property or investments, and the profit is charged corporation tax, and then post corporation tax, the loan is repaid. And it's a capital repayment, most likely with interest attached to that. And therefore, as that loan gets repaid, the capital value of the company increases because the debt goes down, but the capital value of the company increases outside the estate of the person that lent the money. So if you look at it in a 20-year period, say between 50 and 70, that £2 million loan could be entirely paid over a 20-year period. And therefore, what remains in the company is £2 million worth of investments plus all the profit that has accrued in there over the last 20 years. But it's not in the name of the person who made the loan. It's not in the name of the person who's approaching their 70th year. It's in the name of the next generation, but it is still controlled by that individual, as that individual remains a director and has the voting shares. It's a very simple overview, but it can be incredibly effective. And there is still taxation within that structure. There's still dividend taxation if money goes down to the beneficiaries, that the loan remains in the estate of the person that made the loan. So it follows all natural tax, legitimate tax positions for a corporate structure, but it ends up with a structure controlled by, say, the patriarch and matriarch and the economic rights sitting with the next generation. So a pseudo trust, I think, is a good way of looking at it. There's a lot more nuances that are in place, but it's a very solid, gradual passing out down of assets. But most importantly, absolutely most importantly, keeping control of the assets. So harking back to what Steph was saying earlier, asset protection. This is a asset protection technique to control succession planning. There are some very positive aspects regarding income tax, etc., but we're not talking about that now. And those are the type of areas that are likely to be clamped down on regarding HMRC, where they may see corporation tax increase for investment companies. They may see a commercial rate of interest needing to be paid on any loan. They may even place a value on voting shares or tax undistributed income. those are the type of steps they could take to try and make family investment companies less attractive. But my feeling is that if you're looking at it purely on a succession planning point of view, it's the advantages are unlikely to go away. And also, how do they define whether it's just a pure family investment company or whether it's just a family company that has some investments, has some trading, etc.? They'd have to override the whole of corporation law and tax to try and figure out a way of clamping down. So the smaller setups are probably going to be the ones that are going to continue. And I do think for the right person, it's an incredibly good succession planning technique. There are plenty of good webinars out there on family investment companies. You should certainly, if you're not confident with giving advice on family investment companies, you should be linking in with lawyers or accountants that are, as it's something that you should be offering certain clients as a succession planning tool. Right, enough of me. The final slide will be done by Stephanie. Thank you.
Thanks for that, James. You mentioned earlier, LPA is something that we always touch on in most of our webinars or talks. It's something that I think it's important to give a bit of time to because they're such important documents, but so often overlooked by clients. It's not the thing on their list when they come to talk to us about estate planning. It's usually the thing we mention to them towards the end of a meeting, once they've had an opportunity to talk about their priorities, usually concerns about death, how to mitigate inheritance tax during their lifetime. Those of us who do advise on LPAs realise how important they're becoming as more and more of us are affected by conditions which impact on mental capacity. And I notice that those clients who are aware of lasting powers of attorney and their importance are usually those who've unfortunately had to deal with a family member losing capacity and LPAs not being in place for them. So essentially having a bit of a nightmare in trying to step in and help with their affairs. We always say that most clients should have a financial LPA. You don't need a huge estate for a financial LPA to be useful. Even things like providing clarity to banks about who's allowed to be spoken to, who's allowed to sign off on things. We find it's increasingly important for financial advisors having that document in place. And above all, we just want to avoid a situation where individuals have to go through the costly and time-consuming process of making an application to the Court of Protection for a deputy to be appointed. Those clients who are a bit more familiar with lasting powers of attorney, some of them do have the old form enduring powers of attorney or lasting powers of attorney in place. And in many cases, these would be fit for purpose because they appoint appropriate people as attorneys. But most of them are lacking that wording about the delegation of discretionary fund management. Now, that's one of the main reasons we find we have to do new LPAs for people who perhaps already had them in place. That is becoming more and more essential for more institutions like financial advisors. They want to see that wording in there to be comfortable that they can continue to manage investments on a discretionary basis, so that the individual isn't left to stock pick. Clients more and more like to ensure that their business affairs are kept separate from their personal affairs. That can be well provided for in a carefully drafted will, but the same applies to mental capacity. It's possible to do a financial LPA for personal affairs, perhaps appointing members of the family, and one that relates more to the business side of things, perhaps appointing fellow business partners. The health LPAs are often seen as less essential. It's very personal as to whether clients have strong views as to whether they want one or not. But we're living in a world where we increasingly have clients come to us with blended families, second marriages, children from previous marriages. In that situation, it's so important that they do make those decisions about who would take the reins if they lost capacity, so say in your ultimate life support machine situation, because so much effort goes into making sure there are not arguments after death, it's important to make sure that those arguments don't happen when someone's on a life support machine and decisions need to be made about their health and care. And in either case, when it comes to LPAs, Just like with trusts and wills, it's the choice of attorneys that's crucial, not the content of the LPAs themselves. On the whole, we tend to keep LPAs quite vanilla, keep them quite simple. The OPG can be quite tricky when it comes to adding specific instructions, so we don't want to give them any reason to reject or question the LPAs. Detail is fine to go in an accompanying letter of wishes to sit alongside the LPA, and that's usually our preferred route. So just a final note, again, a bit of negativity, but delays are common at the moment. As we mentioned earlier, we're in a difficult environment at the moment. So if this is something that your clients need, just do go ahead, get on with it and try to drive them forward, just so we're moving things on as quickly as we can at our end. Thanks very much. That's me all done.
Thank you, Stephanie. Yes, well, thank you for tuning in and reaching the end. This has been one heck of a year. Quite frankly, if you're a private client practitioner, a defining year. We have had to step up to the plate. And while we haven't had the same traumas and difficulties of somebody on the front line in the NHS, for example, we have had to adapt and we have had to work very hard to get our clients in a position that they feel comfortable with. There's obviously been some moments of tragedy. There's also been some moments of actually getting things done in a very positive way. So I wish you all the best of luck for 2021. Hopefully the webinar was helpful and informative about what we've had in 2020 and what we can expect in 2021. Stay as current as you can. Keep an eye on any impending tax changes. And when they come, learn them and follow them as well as you can, because clients are going to need all the help they can get from us. Anyway, thank you very much indeed again, and happy Christmas and happy New Year. All the best. Bye.